Welcome to the Echo Community Church Podcast. At Echo, we're all about being and making disciples of Jesus Christ. And on this podcast, you'll hear solid teaching from the Bible from our pastors at Echo. Thanks for checking us out and enjoy the message.
Now let's get back into the book of Genesis. If you've been with us for any length of time, you know we started at Genesis 1 and we've been going through Genesis a chapter at a time. We have not read every single verse, but we have looked at every single chapter. And one of our approaches here at Echo is we believe in teaching the entire Bible. And the easiest way to keep us as pastors focused is we pick a book and we go through it. Genesis is 50 chapters long. And some of you in great humility, but great transparency have said, "Pastor, I'm having some Genesis fatigue. You know, could we pick a different part and then come back to this?" And I get it. Genesis is 50 chapters long. I calculated. I've spent over 42 hours of my life standing here talking to you about Genesis. That's a lot of hours for you to listen. It's a lot of hours for me to talk. And then you could double it because I do it twice every Sunday. So really, I guess it's like over 80 hours of my life I've spent just teaching Genesis. And we're at Genesis 37. And, you know, I did think, you know what, maybe there is some merit to this because we could always come back. We could go tackle a shorter book, take a break, and come back. Here's the problem. Genesis chapter 37 starts the story of Joseph. Now, I raise of hands. Please don't feel embarrassed because not everybody who participates in church has spent a lot of time in the Bible. In fact, if you haven't spent a lot of time in the Bible, you're at the right place. I'm glad you're here. You're among friends, okay? Because we all started there. Now, how many of you have at least heard of Joseph? Probably the most commonly known thing about him, even people who aren't very familiar with the Bible, would be his wardrobe early on in his life. What did he wear? I heard one of you say Technicolor. I appreciated that. Yeah. Andrew Lloyd Webber got a hold of that one, right? Yeah, he's probably most well known early in his life for his special clothing. And now think about this, though, for a second. One of the biggest questions humans have is, where did the earth come from? Where did we come from? How did we get here? How did it all start? And we go down the scientific trail of trying to present different theories that scratch that itch and answer that question. Now, the Bible's not silent on that question. The Bible devotes some real estate at the very beginning of it, in the very first chapter, the first few paragraphs. The Bible gives us God's revealed truth, his answer to the question where we came from. Now, rough estimate, you can guess here, how many chapters of the whole Bible are devoted to God answering the question, where did the earth come from? Well, one full one, chapter 2 fleshes it out a little more. Maybe if we really want to be generous, we could say 3 chapters of the Bible are devoted to this question. Now, a lot of us would say, I would like more chapters on that. I want all the science. I want to know, was there a bang? Was there not? I want to know about dinosaurs. I want to know. The Bible never presents itself to us as a science book. Okay, it doesn't skirt the issue. It's not silent. The Bible gives, though, what to many is an unsatisfactory answer. Well, it just says that God existed before our beginning. He had no beginning, but we did. So in our beginning, God already existed. He was pre-existent. And basically, he said some words and everything was created. And for a lot of us, it's like, that's really insufficient. Leaves a lot of room here. And it's insufficient unless God's exactly who he tells us he is. If, in fact, God did exist before we did and has always existed and has no beginning, and he's powerful enough to do whatever he wants, and he can create out of nothing, then this all makes complete sense, and that's all the explanation we need. But now let me compare that. He gives us 3 chapters on that. Do you know how many chapters he gives us just on the story of this dude with the coat? 14. And a lot of us are like, God, you have misallocated. I have a whole lot more to gain out of knowing where the world came from than I do out of what you're doing in this guy's life. And it's not necessarily true. In fact, when you look at this guy's life, you and I would not be sitting here today were it not for what God did in this man's life. We wouldn't. I'll show it to you. That's not just hyperbole. That's not preacher talk. That's historic fact. If this guy doesn't end up the prime minister of Egypt, his whole family gets wiped out by starvation. And if his family gets wiped out, the 66 living members of his family at the end of Genesis, you understand that the whole bloodline of where Jesus was coming from gets wiped out, and he doesn't get born. And if Jesus is not born, you and I might live, but we'd live a hopeless life without a Savior. Now, are you saying that Joseph's life is more important than the story of where the world came from? No, I'm not trying to make an argument that one story is more important than another story. What I'm telling you, though, is that if we get Genesis fatigue and we cut this out, we're cutting out the part of the book that has the most information in it that God is saying, the one thing I don't want you to miss about this time period is the life of Joseph. I'm going to write 5x the content on Joseph as I do about where the world came from. It's that important that we get it. So we're not going to skip over it, but we will move with some pace. We'll be done with this by November. I've recalibrated some things. We'll be done with Genesis by November. But I hope that after all this, you can see I have a better understanding of who God is. And if you cut Genesis 37 out of the Bible, you're going to miss the clearest place the Bible ever talks about what to do and how to deal with the bad things that happen to us. The bad stuff. The stuff that we all have dealt with, or we're all dealing with, or there's somebody in your life right now that's going through it. The bad stuff, the terrible things, the painful things that we're dealing with because either of our own sin, we're dealing with not, maybe not because of our own sin, but somebody else near us has sinned against us, they've hurt us, they've harmed us, or we're dealing with it because it's just part of the broken, sinful world that we live in, but we're dealing with it. And I know some fellow Christians who have some thinking this way. But I would say I also have a lot of friends and family members who do not consider themselves Christians. Some of them are hostile towards religion, God, Christianity. Some are neutral. Some are even favorable towards it. But I would say probably the most centralized issue some of my friends have who are not Christians is this. How can I believe in a God that sees all this bad stuff happening and is supposed to be powerful enough to do something about it but doesn't? Explain that to me. Explain starving children to me. Explain genocide to me. Explain rape and assault to me. Explain how can your loving God see all this stuff and walk by? And what they conclude is either there is no God or the God that we have is not loving. And I hear a different version of that among other fellow Christians, because they assume this: if I'm struggling, if I'm suffering, if I'm hurting, if there's just a lot of bad stuff, let's make it more simple. If 3 appliances go up in the same week, all of a sudden, the devil is running roughshod over your family and God doesn't love you anymore. If the transmission goes out before the car's paid for, if your salary goes down, even though you're tithing, if somebody in your family that you love is suffering, or they die prematurely, or they die in a way that is horrific and unexpected, especially painful, even the ones that walk close to Jesus, a lot of us wrestle with, maybe God is angry with me, because in my mind, a loving God can't coexist with this type of stuff happening. So maybe he's just absent. And if I could boil down and centralize the one issue I'm called into as a pastor or as a friend to help resolve in people's lives, I could put a lot of them in this bucket. Can you help me make sense out of the bad stuff I'm dealing with? People inside of Christianity, outside of Christianity, doesn't matter. A lot of us are spending a lot of time trying to deal with mentally, physically, financially, spiritually, socially, with bad stuff that's happening. And if you take Genesis 37 out of the Bible, you miss one of the most obvious places, perhaps the most obvious place, the Bible tackles this issue head on. And if you'll look into this story and you'll take a bold, fearless look at yourself and the characters and just the plot of this whole story. Listen, this story is about a messed up family. There are no heroes in this chapter. None. They're all messy. They're all poisoned. It's a messed up family, a dysfunctional family that God uses to save the world. So listen, if you come from a messed up family, you're a prime candidate for God to use you, James Ward. And if you come from a messed up family, that doesn't mean that you're written off. He redeems, topples, and defangs some brutality He doesn't step in and prevent it. And what you'll actually see is if he steps in and prevents it at this point in the story, we're all lost. And yet, the brutality of the story doesn't win in the end. It actually serves as an instrument that lifts people into the positions that God intended them to be to save people from famine and the world from sin. And in that way, it can be beautiful, but it's also tough. Let me read to you the first few verses of this story. We won't read the whole chapter today. Don't worry. Some of you looked ahead. You're like, 36 verses. We've got stuff to do. I got you. I feel that. But let's look at this, all right? We're here. Let's learn. Here we go. Genesis 37, verse 1. So Jacob settled again. Jacob is Joseph's father. For those of you kind of new into the story, Jacob is Joseph's dad, okay? He is the grandson of another famous person, the patriarch. Thank you. Thank you for being here today, Megan. Thank you for doing it. What's that? You're West today? Okay, I got you. I got you. I got you. He's texting. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Abraham, God made. Here's the big arc of the whole story. We'll do some foreshadowing today. You know about Joseph's coat of many colors. Let's see what other trivia you know. All right. Joseph's great granddad is Abraham. God made a promise to Abraham. The world is broken. Man has sinned, but I'm going to save the world through you rather than just writing us all off. I'm going to buy people back. And so I'm going to make a promise with you that out of you is going to come a family, and out of your family is going to come a nation. Out of that nation is going to come tribes, and out of those tribes is going to come one king, and that king is going to save the whole world from sin forever. That's my promise to you, Abraham, and I'm not going to break it. The challenge is Abraham's not necessarily an example of all the best things, is he? Do we go to Genesis to find out how to have a healthy marriage? We don't. Okay. Abraham, not exactly the prime model of a great husband. He has a son named Isaac. Isaac has Jacob and Esau, right? Does Isaac do a great job of showing us how to parent? Not really. You can learn by reverse osmosis, but then, you know, Jacob has four wives and a whole bunch of kids, but one wife that he loves more than the rest, and that wife has two boys and one boy that he loves more than the rest, and that boy is Joseph, and Joseph is the central figure of this part of the story. Now, do you know where Joseph's ultimately going to work? What's his job going to be? What government's he going to work for? The Egyptian government. He's going to be number two in charge, prime minister. Now, keep that in mind when we read this story, because he doesn't even live there. He knows no Egyptians, doesn't know the Pharaoh. Now, why is it in God's plan to get Joseph into the prime minister's spot? There's a natural catastrophe coming that God knows about that they don't know about. What's that catastrophe? Famine. And God wants to save that part of the region's population from the death that famine would bring. Here's the problem. Nobody knows it's coming. Nobody has a plan. The Pharaoh of Egypt doesn't know it's coming, doesn't have a plan. The person God's going to use is currently a 17-year-old tattletale wearing fancy clothes and selling out his brothers to his dad. He doesn't live in Egypt, knows no Egyptians, has no supply chain management training, none of it. Now, if the guy God's going to use never gets the job, what happens to the population of Egypt? They die. What happens to the 66 wandering remnant of Abraham out in the fields of Canaan? What happened to them? They'll die. And if they die, does Jesus come into the world through a dead family? You see what's riding on all of this. God's got a big plan he's working for, but the pieces aren't lined up. Now, here we go. Jacob settled again in the land of Canaan where his father had lived as a foreigner. This is the account of Jacob and his family. When Joseph was how old? 17. How old was Joseph in the story? Okay, 17. So let's go back to whatever you learned about Joseph. Do not imagine him as a little 5-year-old rugrat running around with cute clothes and his big brothers were bullying him. He's 17. For all intents and purposes, he's a full-grown man at this point. He often tended his father's flocks. He worked for his, now we've already got an introduction of the drama. He worked for his half-brothers, the sons of his father's wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. But Joseph reported, that's the Hebrew word for an ill-intended, inaccurate report to his father, some of the bad things his brothers were doing.
We're going to come back to this because every time you go into a story, even if it's the 150th time, the Bible is living and active and you see things. One of the things I've missed the first 150 or 200 times through the story is that, of course, I didn't have access or understanding that I need to look at what these Hebrew words mean. And I used to think that it was just Joseph seeing something the brothers were doing wrong and going and telling his dad accurately what they were doing,
which makes him maybe a tattletale. But the Hebrew word here for report is used differently from other reports. The Hebrew word for report here means an inaccurate misrepresentation. Here's what was going on. Joseph was seeing, most likely, Joseph was seeing something bad the brothers were doing, but the Hebrew uses two words here, one for an inaccurate misleading report, the second one for evil motives. So what he does is Joseph uses and leverages his position as daddy's favorite to go to dad, and maybe there was something wrong that the brothers were doing. They were doing something wrong, but Joseph took that story and exaggerated it or misconstrued it and misrepresented it to his father as fact to make the brothers look even worse because of Joseph's own motives in his heart to poke at his brothers who acted hateful towards him. You see what's going on here? It clarifies a little bit of some of the sibling dysfunction and rivalry that's going on. Let's keep going. Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other children. That is such an... that's a jarring statement. Here's a dad of 12 who the Bible just says very plainly, very openly, he loved Joseph more. It doesn't say he treated him better. It says he loved him more. Wow. Now I want you to watch... So Jacob has already poisoned himself by favoritism in his own life, and now he's putting it in the lives of his boys. Now watch how it impacts. Because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. So one day Jacob had a special gift made for Joseph, a beautiful robe. So he gives him money and lavishes gifts on him that he doesn't the other boys and does it in an obvious way. He's not even hiding it. It's not even like you were convinced growing up that your parents had favorites, but you could never prove it. Jacob unapologetically puts it out there, and Joseph knows it and leverages it, and the brothers know it. And in verse 4, it says, they hated. How did they feel about Joseph? They hated. They hated Joseph because their father loved him more than the rest of them. Now, here's one of the things that it manifested. Their hate, they couldn't say a kind word to him. Verse 5. One night, Joseph had a dream. Note, it does not say God sent him a dream. He had a dream. In fact, in this entire chapter, we won't see God mentioned once. This is a story of an ordinary dude. In fact, in Joseph's whole arc, you will see no miracles. In his whole story, you will not see God breaking in this way like he did with Moses, like he did with Noah, like he does with David, like Elisha and Elijah. A lot of the heroes of the Old Testament, we watch their story, and it's filled with, or at least it builds towards these times where God breaks in and there is fire, or there's a miracle, or seas split, or water comes out of a rock, or sticks turns into snakes, back into sticks, or a giant falls down, or fire comes out of heaven and burns things down. Not in Joseph's life. None of it. And yet God is working in all the details in ways that seem unspectacular to us because they're kind of hidden. And yet we learn that God's been working and managing all the details to bring his work about. He told his brothers about it and they hated it. You see a theme? They're repeating words here. He told them the dream and they hated him more than ever. And here's the irony. Joseph knows when he tells his brothers about these kinds of dreams, they react hatefully. And knowing that, he tells them the dreams. Listen to this dream. He said, we were out in the field tying up bundles of grain. Suddenly, my bundle of grain stood up and all your bundles gathered around and bowed low before mine. Now, is this doing anything to soften the existing rivalry between them? No. Joseph's 17 and he's smart. He knows his brothers hate him because we already learned that. He knows they can't speak kindly towards him. And he knows how this dream would sound to his brothers. And he tells them anyway. Verse 8. So his brothers responded, so you think you'll be our king, do you? Do you actually think you'll reign over us? And they hated him all the more. Do you see the theme? They hated him, then they hated him more, then they hated him all the more because of his dreams, but not just about his dreams, and the way he talked about them. Now, there are some, if you go into my bibliography, you can pull up some of the sermons and the teachers that I went to, and there are some who will tell you the Bible never speaks a negative word about Joseph. He's only ever held in a positive light. And until recently, that was a lot of the historical commentary, but that's a disservice to what the chapter is actually showing us. It doesn't make Joseph out to be perfect. It shows that there are some hidden flaws in his character. One of which, well, let's just keep reading. You'll see it even more. Like, soon Joseph had another dream. Now, here's the thing. Let's pause right here. How did his first telling of his dreams with his brothers go over? Not well. They hated him before the dream. They hated him while he was repeating it. They hated him afterwards, and he knew it. Little brother knows what buttons to press to get this reaction out of older brothers. Now, does this bother him? No. Why? And again, he told his brothers about it. He knows the reaction his behaviors elicit from the people who are hearing it, and it doesn't deter him, it attracts him. This is the beginning of a sociopath. But I'm serious. A sociopath is someone who is indifferent to the reactions of other people's feelings when they behave a certain way. And here is a guy who, you can soften it, put it in language, he is a button pusher. Now, none of you in this room are a button pusher, but we all have buttons. And when they're pressed, the behavior comes out. There's a certain strain of humanity that gets entertained by pressing buttons. There's a term that I learned about from our middle school guidance counselor called rage baiting. Where middle school kids understand who has tempers, and they figure out how to press buttons with that person long enough to get their temper, get them to blow their top, and then they laugh and they mock and they record and they just say, "Oh, you can't take a joke." That's a symptom of being a sociopath. That person's reaction does nothing for me. In fact, it actually kind of entertains me. Pastor, are you saying Joseph is a sociopath? No, I'm saying look at the hidden issues in his heart that are contributing to this mess. He has another dream after the first one went poorly, and it drew out hateful, it didn't make his brothers feel good, it drew out hateful feelings from them. It paints him in the best possible light, which is already it's already the reality of his life that makes his brothers mad, and he hides behind it and he leverages it and says, "I have another dream. This time the sun, moon, and 11 stars bowed low before me." Well, what kind of reaction do you think he's expecting? More hate. Verse 10. This time he told the dream to his father as well as to his brothers. Now here's a crazy phrase. But his father scolded him. Let's put two facts next to each other from this passage. Let's see how they work out. Jacob loved Joseph more than the rest of them. Jacob scolded Joseph. Do you know how bad your favorite has to be to publicly scold them? Do you know how hard it must have been for Jacob to scold Joseph? But he does. "What kind of dream is that?" he asked. "Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" This is so offensive because in the ancient Near East culture, the younger son never, the older boys never bow down to the younger sibling. The younger sibling always deferred to the older. You won't see any place in the Old Testament where it's like the 11th out of 12, he is the one who's going to be the prime inheritor of things. He's going to be, no, they're farther down the food chain. And here you got the favorite coming along and say, "Guys, you know what? Dad loves me best, and one day you're going to bow down to me." And they're like, "This is backwards. This is very offensive." And then he says to his parents, "And you're going to bow down to me." And they're like, "You can't talk like this, Joseph. That's a terrible thing to say. It's an awful thing to say. Don't you see what you're doing here? Are you really think we're going to do this? You're crazy. You're out of your mind. Keep that stuff to yourself. At the very least, you have no tact, but at the very most, we see some signs. He could take a turn and become very prideful, very arrogant, very cruel, very manipulative. Maybe he's not full-blown given himself to this, but there's something brewing in Joseph. There's something been brewing in Jacob. There's something brewing in the brothers. If somebody don't deal with it, the whole thing is going to come and explode. And some of you know the story, and it does. So what do we do with this whole mess? I want to leave a big idea with you today. Because like I said, in this whole story, chapter 37, we don't see God's name mentioned. We don't see miracles. We don't see a dramatic, Joseph's going to need rescued in a few minutes, isn't he? You know the story, where does he end up? What do the brothers do to him? Do they kill him? No. What do? They strip him of his clothes, they throw him in a cistern, and then they sell him. And we learn later on, as Joseph is reminiscing years later with his brothers about this scene, he says, I cried out. I called out from the cistern while y'all were eating lunch, and nobody helped me. Joseph could have very likely sat in this season of his life and said, where is God in this whole mess? And yet what we learn in this story, and it's echoed throughout the Bible, is this statement, God's silence is not God's absence. God's silence is not his absence. When I say silence, we live in a modern era where God speaks to all of us in different ways. He speaks to us, maybe the primary, primary way, through his word. He speaks to us today, for those of us who are in Christ, and Christ is in us. God speaks to his children who have been saved through his Holy Spirit that lives within us. God can speak to us through nature. God can speak to us through his messengers. God can speak to us through circumstances. I'm not talking about a time when God just makes your Bible go blank and shuts you off from the ability to communicate with other people. What I mean is maybe a different analogy. Sometimes when you look through the windshield of life, it looks like God's being silent because you don't see him in anything. He's not in your job. He's not in your marriage. He's not at home. He's not in your circumstances. He's not in your physical wellness or your material well-being. You don't see him anywhere through the windshield. You're just like, where in the world is God? He's being silent. Therefore, he must be absent. And what the Bible shows us in this story is just when God, I will say it this way, when he is less obvious, even when he's maybe hidden, he's not absent. He's always working, managing all the details. And if you really believe this, your life will be completely transformed. Do you know what kind of poise you'll live with? If when you look through the windshield, if you don't see God's fingerprints on everything, you know what kind of poise you can live with and be like, just because I don't see his fingerprints everywhere, I know he's present. I know he's with me. I will not be flapped. I am unflappable. I will not be sunk. I am unsinkable. Even if I can't see him through the windshield, I know he's with me. And every time I forget, I just look in the rearview mirror and I see his fingerprints very clearly to things that have already happened. God's silence is not his absence. I want us to look at this very, very, very closely. There's some hidden things going on in chapter 1. There's some things about, it's showing us that there's some hidden sin brewing under the surface. And there's three individuals or groups that are poisoned. Jacob's poisoned already, Joseph's poisoned already, and the brothers are poisoned already by sin. Now Jacob, dad in the story, he's been poisoned by a certain sin called favoritism. Now did he just wake up one day and become a guy who plays favorites? No, that's kind of the cultural generational struggle of his entire family. We go back to Abraham. Abraham had his first two boys. Isaac and Ishmael. Did he play favorites? Yes. Who did he prefer? Isaac sends Ishmael away. I don't want to be reminded of you. Isaac, you're the favorite. So Isaac grows up. Isaac gets married. Isaac has two boys. You remember them? The smooth one and the hairy one, right? Right? You're like, Pastor, are you trying to be both at one time? Just stop. We don't know what's going on. We're just a thing. Midlife crisis. Jacob and Esau. Now, who was dad's favorite of Jacob and Esau? Esau, who was mom's favorite. Was that a problem in their family? Oh, yeah. Deceit, manipulation, treachery, sibling rivalry. And Jacob, if you remember, never had his dad's full affection. He knew he wasn't the chosen one. His own life, if you want to put on your counseling psychological profile hat, Jacob grew up without having a strong relationship with his dad because dad preferred his brother. So he always had this gap in his heart. I need to be loved. I need to be approved. And so when he became old enough to start thinking about getting married, he sees Rachel. And he says, man, Rachel, right? Yeah, Leah. I get Rebecca and Rachel confused in my brain. Rachel, he's like, man, if I could marry her, my life will be right. If I could have her love and her affection. And he eventually does marry her after he marries her sister and before he marries two others. He ends up with four wives, but there's one he loves the most. And the one he loves the most, he's like, if I can just have a child from her, my life will be complete. And she gives him Joseph. And then what's the second one she gives him? Benjamin. And she dies giving birth to Benjamin. So the one he loved the most, the one whose approval he wanted the most, is gone. So he just transfers that need for an idol in his heart and he puts it on Joseph. And he unapologetically now, because he's been poisoned by the sting of a family torn apart by favoritism and sibling rivalry, he now brings that into his new family. He's poisoned. And we see what some of that poison does. You think your stuff under the surface, you're doing a good job of hiding it? Friend, it's poisoning people close to you that are dealing with the fallout of our unaddressed secret, quiet issues that we hide behind stuff. So Jacob's already poisoned. We've seen Joseph is poisoned. Joseph's been poisoned by a budding pride, desire to manipulate, to be in control, by a lack of tact, by perhaps some sociopathic tendencies. They're not full blown yet, but he's been able to kind of grab onto this because of dad's issues, which have now become his issues. His brothers hate him and hate him more and hate him all the more. His brothers can't speak kindly to him because dad loves him most. And rather than Joseph recognizing that and having a level of self-awareness to diffuse this, he just embraces this whole thing. He wears, in Hebrew, a tunic of many colors. And let me read you the exact, according to Dr. James Boyce, the real idea behind the ancient Hebrew tunic was that it was a tunic extending all the way down to the wrists, all the way down to the ankles, as opposed to shorter ones that people working would wear. It's not what a working man wore. It was a garment showing privilege and status. The man who wore a tunic of many colors watched others as they did the work. They didn't actually do the work. So you got all these guys doing hard labor, and brother 11 out of 12 is coming out every day in his tunic. Well, guys, I would love to help, but I'll watch. I'll help tend the sheep, but I'll just watch. And if I see you cutting any corners or taking an extra long lunch or cutting deals you shouldn't be or goofing off while you should be watching sheep, I'm going to go tell dad. And he does go tell dad. And when he tells dad, he takes what they did and he adds a little extra to it to make the brothers look even worse and himself look even better. And dad's buying all of it. So how many times do you think the brothers get punished for an inaccurate report that Joseph brings back because they're being poisoned from Joseph's and Jacob's poisoning? And what's their poisoning? Hate. Jealousy. Injustice. Are they being treated fairly? No. I remember Arielle shared one week, she said, I learned in my life the most natural thing I could ever do is be a mom. She said the most natural thing a mom can do is love her children. And so when there's a lack of love there, she thinks this just must be so unnatural. And here you have a dad who you would think the most natural thing that he could do is love all of his boys. It just, he loves one more. Not only does he love one more, he leans into it, owns it, sets him aside, and allows Joseph to lean into it. Do you see just how tangled this all is? Do you see how tangled this is? I just want to make sure I can move on. You see, I will keep moving if you answer the question right. You see, it's tangled. You know, that's like our lives. Our lives get tangled. We're messed up. We're all broken people. We're related to broken people. We've given birth to broken people. We were born from broken people. We work for broken people. Broken people work for us. Life's going to get messy. If you haven't figured this out, I would like to tell you life's going to get neater. It's not. It's going to get worse, and then it's going to be better all the way better for eternity. But look into this family. You see, the Bible is not about a bunch of people who live perfect lives that we're just supposed to mimic them and find God. The Bible just says we're all broken and God came to find us. There's nobody in this story at this point who we say, you know what? That's the way to parent. That's the way to raise children. That's the way to react to your brothers. That's the way to deal with injustice. They're all being poisoned by these inner issues. Jacob's favoritism, Joseph's arrogance and pride and tactlessness and self-unawareness, the brother's jealousy and greed. It's like looking at a mountain before the volcano erupts. And you're like looking at the picture, looking at nothing. And then all of a sudden you see the stop motion. You're like the whole thing slides away and the top just goes off. There's all kinds of things brewing under the surface. And here's the story asks us two questions. I got to make this personal. It's uncomfortable. Here's a question I want to ask you. Is there something brewing underneath the surface of your life that'll destroy you if you don't deal with it? You see, there's stuff brewing in Jacob's life, Joseph's life, all of us. It's brewing. We see it. The author lets us in. We see it. That underneath the surface, there is a recipe here like Mentos in the soda bottle. It's about to blow. Now, what I can tell you from my own personal experience in my own life, when I look back at the times that if I were a mountain that the volcano erupted in a destructive way, it hurt myself, it hurt others. Every single time without fail, it wasn't just some random incident. Someone just walked by and dropped a Mentos in there. It was stuff that had been brewing for a long time that I didn't deal with. Because it started so small and insignificant, I thought I could manage it. And then when I got worried about managing it, I just shifted to, I'll just throw people off the trail. I'll just hide it. It's a lot of work. So as a Christian myself, I learned how you hide the stuff under the surface. One thing is you don't even admit it to yourself. You say, this isn't a problem. This isn't an issue. I've got it under control. Nobody will find out. Or, it's not really my fault anyway. It's not really my issue. So we lie to ourselves. We hide it from ourselves. We think we're hiding it from God. One of the ways Christians love to hide it is through Christian activity. I've got the smiley face. I know all the answers in church. I know the songs. Sometimes I come to 9 and 11. I do a double header. I give. I serve. I go to Etsy and order Bible verses and hang them up all over my house. Every third post is something spiritual. This is one of the ways that those of us who are Christ followers think we're hiding the issues under the surface. You know, the pictures we post of our marriage, is it like the two of you arguing over who left the ketchup on the counter? No. It is, pictures we put up of our kids, is it them arguing over who hit who first? Is it them debating with you the schedule that you have in mind for their bathing and going to bed? Is it you convincing them that they actually need to contribute to the operation of the household by please putting their socks away at least one time? Sorry. No, you get it. As believers especially, because we know there's a stigma attached to the stuff underneath the surface, we'd rather just spend more effort in keeping that thing out of the public eye than really just dealing with it. And what I'm going to tell you, from my own experience, is if you don't deal with it, the top will blow off and it'll hurt you and others. Because I've done it. I've done it. I've let things grow and grow and grow and grow. And I spent more effort in trying to keep it a secret. Because I thought I could manage it. I thought I could handle it. I thought I was in control of it. And you just keep lying to yourself and you're lying to God. And I will tell you, eventually and ultimately, it'll destroy. It'll cause destruction if you don't deal with it. Happens in this family. Don't let it happen to you. And if that's you today, let me be very practical. Let me give you a next step, just one. Confess. Confess. It's not the last step. It is the first step. In non-theological terms, confessed means to admit the truth. In theological terms, it means to agree with what God already knows is true. So if you admit to something that you don't think is true, but you're just saying it, it's not a confession. If you state something that you know isn't accurate or incomplete, it's not a confession. But when you agree with God about the truth, it starts a healing process. Doesn't complete it, but it starts it. You need to confess to yourself and God. That's where this starts. You need to at least say to yourself, I've got a problem, I've got an issue. There's something boiling under the surface. Now, it could be something under the surface that's because of your own sinfulness. That's me. It could be something you're dealing with that has nothing to do with your own sin, but it's your way under the surface of trying to deal with someone else's sin that has negatively impacted you. You're trying to deal with it. The brothers, they're dealing with their father's favoritism towards their brother. Now, they didn't cause that, but what happened was they started building up hatred and resentment and led them to murder, or at least murderous plot. Led them to the point where they thought so little of their brother, they could beat him within an inch of his life, strip him naked, throw him in the cistern, leaving him for dead, and eat lunch while he cried out for help. That's a pretty hardened place to be for a human. But it didn't start there. It got there because it wasn't dealt with. Sometimes you're just dealing with internally the pain that comes from just living in a broken world, and there's circumstances you didn't ask for, but they're yours. The three appliances that broke. The job promise that was made and then walked back on. Just the sadness and the heaviness of living in a broken city or a broken neighborhood in a broken world and feeling like, is there any nice person out there anymore? Is there any person I can truly trust that is working for everybody's good and is not personally motivated? Is there anybody out there that doesn't have some type of a personal agenda that can weigh on us? But if that's where you're at, admit it to yourself. I'm going to stop lying to me. This is a problem. I remember the day that the first chain fell off to me. I finally just said to God, yes, I did all the things I've been denying. I did them all. And I didn't feel great, but I felt a weight off my shoulder, and I felt like God saying, okay, now we can make some progress. You confess it to God. God, this is what I'm dealing with. You know and I know. Here it is. I invite you in. And then at that point, depending on what it is, there's different places you may need to go. But it starts the healing process. So if this is where you're at, I don't want to send you home without a prognosis. If this part is speaking to you, confess it to yourself. Get real with you. Get real with God. Well, what happens if he really knows? He already knows. You're not going to shock him. He knows. He knows. But what that does is that you now open up every opportunity for God to come in and begin. Here's what I know. If we confess our sins, he is faithful, he is just, he will forgive us from our sins and make us clean from all our unrighteousness, 1 John 1:9. So that's one of the questions. Let me read the last part of the story. I'm not going to read the whole chapter. Last part of the story, a second question, and then we'll close. Let me pick up the story at verse 12. And here's what I want you to watch. Follow the coincidences. I'll draw attention to them by saying, just happened to when we get there. I'm not trying to add to the Bible. Okay, I just want to, if I could just like highlight and circle some things, that's what I'm going to do here. So watch. Soon after this, Joseph's brothers just happened to pasture their father's flocks at Shechem. When they had been gone for some time, Jacob on a particular day just happened to say to Joseph, your brothers are pasturing the sheep at Shechem. Get ready, and I'll send you to them. I'm ready to go, Joseph replied. Go and see how your brothers and the flocks are getting along, Jacob said. Then come back and bring me a report. This is a different word for report than the earlier one. He's wanting an accurate report. Okay. So Jacob sent him on his way, and Joseph traveled to Shechem from their home in the valley of Hebron. When he arrived there, a man from the area just happened to notice Joseph wandering around the countryside. What you looking for? He asked. He just happened to ask. As an introvert, I do not just walk up to strangers and say, hey, what you looking for? I'm just like, man, that guy's looking for something. Hope he finds it. You know, like, and I just keep walking. I'm looking for my brothers, Joseph replied. Do you happen to know where they are pasturing their sheep? What? Yes, the man told him. They moved on from here, but I just happened to hear them say, let's go on to Dothan. So Joseph followed his brothers to Dothan and just happened to find them there. Verse 18, when Joseph's brothers saw him coming, they recognized him in the distance, and as he approached, they made plans to kill him. Have you heard this part of the story before? Okay, a couple of you have, all right. Here comes the dreamer, they said. Come on, let's kill him. You see how deep this has grown? Now it's just casual for brothers to discuss the murder of their own. I don't want to intrude into your family business. I can just say that even on the days when my brother and sister and I, we're not getting along. This was never casual conversation. Okay. Let's kill him, and then let's collude and conspire to cover it up. This is dark. They really hate him. We can tell our father a wild animal has eaten him, then we'll see what becomes of his dreams. But when Reuben heard of their scheme, he came to Joseph's rescue. Let's not kill him, he said. Why should we shed any blood? Let's just throw him into this empty cistern that just happens to be here in the wilderness. Then he'll die without our laying a hand on him. But Reuben was secretly planning to rescue Joseph and return him to his father. Verse 23, so when Joseph arrived, his brothers ripped off the beautiful robe he was wearing. I also want, it would be proper for me to say, and I realize in the first service, I don't have time to draw this out today. Joseph points to Jesus in a lot of different ways. You'll see a lot of things in Joseph's life that are a foreshadowing of Jesus, and a few things in Joseph's life that are the opposite of Jesus. But here's a very clear one. Jesus was forsaken by his own brothers. He came into a pretty messed up family. You know the scandal that went around about his parents? And mom being pregnant and says she never slept with a man. And then he comes into the world and it tells us his own brothers and sisters didn't receive him. And he was eventually stripped of his clothes. Wasn't he sold by Judas for a certain amount of money? So there's a lot of ways in which he points to. Joseph finds himself in the middle of two convicts, and so does Jesus. There's a lot of things in there. They grabbed him, threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty, and there was no water in it. Just as they were sitting down to eat. It's crazy. It's how cold they were towards him. He's in there screaming for help, we learn later. And they're having sandwiches or whatever it was that they ate. They looked up and just happened to see at that very moment a caravan of camels in the distance coming toward them. Now, some of you will catch the irony of this. It was a group of Ishmaelites. Isn't that interesting? The son that Abraham sent away now have grown up enough to have some ites. And the ites become an instrument that God used to transport Joseph from there to eat. He might have been silent. No way was he absent. You couldn't make this up unless this happened. They were taking a load of gum balm and aromatic resin from Gilead down to Egypt. Judas said to his brothers, the lion from the tribe of, what will we gain by killing our brother? We'd have to cover up the crime. Instead of hurting him, let's sell him to the Ishmaelite traders. After all, he's our flesh and blood. And the story goes on. They sell him to the traders take him to Egypt. Here's the second question the story asks. I look at this and I say, why is this so stinking brutal? Couldn't God have gotten Joseph there in another way? Why is it so brutal? And here the story is asking us to deal with a question that I posed earlier. Here's the second question. Do you think God's love is compatible with your terrible struggles? Do you really believe deep in your heart that even when I'm struggling, and in my struggle and my pain and my suffering and all of us, Christians are good boo-boo comparison. People, you had a boo-boo over here, you had a boo-boo here. Like, Christians are good at comparing our wounds. Well, I know you have it bad, but let me tell you how much worse I had it. Listen, it's relative to all of us. We've all struggled. I don't mean to suggest that my struggles are as bad as what you've been through. And there's people losing their lives all over the world. There are Christians being martyred left and right, underground church in China, that are struggling much worse than what I have. I've listened to Suba share her story with us about the persecution she's facing because of becoming a Christian from her family. But I know struggle relative to me. You know struggle relative to you? Pain, injustice, hurt. I've told you, a lot of my friends outside of Christianity, one of the hard things for them to accept is thinking about a God who can be loving and at the same time, we can be struggling and see pain. And they say it's one or the other. Either there is a God that's angry and mean and is okay and is indifferent to our pain, or there is no God. But there certainly can't be an omnibenevolent God alongside pain and struggle. And if you're a follower of Christ, and the first thing you think about when you walk through anything less than blessing and success is, maybe God's mad at me. Maybe I didn't pay the rent, and this is God's way of getting me. That's why the washer and the dryer and the dishwasher all broke at one time. It's because the devil. God hates me. He's abandoned me. He's absent. If that's part of your thought train, then you're still struggling with this question. Is God's love compatible with your terrible struggles? Let me ask it another way. Is God involved in the details of my struggles in a loving way? Because if God's involved in my struggles in an unloving way, then he's not loving. If God is involved in aware, active, and I could see that he's being loving, he's working for my best, for his best, then I could say God's love, God's wise, redeeming love, is compatible with my struggles. And all I've got time to do is just ask you to just think critically about this whole line of coincidences. In my journey of follower of Christ, I don't believe in coincidence. I don't. I believe God manages it all. So let me read to you how I wrote this out for sake of time. It appears almost coincidentally that Jacob just happened to send Joseph to check on his brothers at Shechem, who just happened not to stay at Shechem anymore, but who decided through audible conversation while they were in Shechem to relocate to Dothan, which is interesting because in Dothan, that was much more remote than Shechem, and anything that happened in Dothan, no one would know about it. They're already thinking nefariously here. However, when they had that conversation, they just happened to have it within earshot of a total stranger who wasn't eavesdropping, was just going about his day. Here's this random group of dudes, brothers, talking about relocating, doesn't think another thing of it and goes about his day just randomly, coincidentally. Joseph just happens to run into a stranger at Shechem, the one stranger in all of Shechem, who just happened to have overheard the brothers divulge their intentions to go to Dothan. Do you see how randomly coincidental this all is? So Joseph heads to Dothan where the brothers grab him, but Reuben just happened to be there to keep him from being killed, but not to prevent him from being sold. And then while he's in the cistern, randomly, some caravan on the way to Egypt who has cash is willing to pay the brothers to offload the problem of Joseph to them so that they don't have to let him die in the cistern, but they can profit from it a little bit and send him on his way to Egypt. Now, where is God trying to get Joseph? He sends him on it's not first class, it's a little less than coach. Do you see the possibility that maybe God's involved in all this? Do you see these are not just a string of coincidences, but down to when that stranger decided to walk past that field, God was involved in all of that. All the little tiny details that seem just like everyday, mundane, ordinary stuff all works together in a certain way. Unless this story unfolds exactly this way, just in this order, everybody dies. If the stranger doesn't know where the brothers are, Joseph never finds them. If Joseph doesn't find them on that day, the caravan's not there to take him to Egypt. And hey, we play the story forward. If he doesn't get to Egypt and doesn't go through that hole, life doesn't get a whole lot better for him for too long in Egypt. But eventually, he meets Pharaoh, interprets his dream, becomes the prime minister, and executes a strategy to spare the world from death in the physical and preserve the 66 person bloodline of Abraham through whom Christ would come if it doesn't tumble out in this way. though God seems to be completely absent on the surface, he must have been managing all the details of all that happened. He was arranging all the things, even the chaotic, terrible, painful things for the salvation of Joseph's family. If it hadn't happened like this, everyone would have been lost physically because of famine and spiritually because of sin. I have to finish this up. I don't have time for that one. Get the study guide. There's some bullet points in here that'll be helpful. Let me leave you with this thought. If Joseph would have been saved from the thing he wanted to be saved from at the time he called out for it in the well, right? If God intervenes, sends an angel, sends whatever he sends, lifts him up out of the cistern, deals with all the brothers' sin. If God saves Joseph from what he wanted to be saved from when he asked for it, Joseph would have been lost in a more profound way later on. You see that. Sometimes you have a person in Dothan crying out to be saved like Joseph, and there's no rescue from heaven. Then 2 Kings chapter 6, a dude named Elisha shows up in Dothan, calls out to God to save him from the enemies. God sends fiery chariots. Peter in Acts is thrown into prison. All the believers pray. God delivers him from prison. John the Baptist is imprisoned. All the followers of Jesus are praying for him. He gets beheaded, and yet I see God working in all those circumstances. God was caring as much for Joseph's life in his hiddenness and in his silence as he was for Elisha and Peter and his dramatic intervention for them. If you really believed this, can you imagine how strong you'd be? If you trusted God's presence, even when he's being hidden, as much as you celebrated when he shows up and delivers, do you imagine the poise you could live with? Do you imagine the faith and the courage that you would have? Do you imagine the instrument that he could use you for when other people around you see the stuff and the terrible things that you're dealing with? And yet you remain poised and you trust in God. Even though I don't see him through the windshield, I've seen him in the rearview mirror of my life. And I know my God is one who's working through all the details. You see, Joseph had to be lost before he could really be saved. And if God unwinds this whole thing then and there, yeah, the brothers might have been able to hug it all out and go home and live happily ever until the famine hits. And then they all die. And there's no Jesus coming through that line. And then you and I have a hopeless present and a futile future. But God was working through all of this. The only way you can kind of reconcile him going through the stuff in the cistern is like, I'm glad God didn't rescue him from his cistern because he never would have gotten to Egypt. And I can look back at my own life and say, I'm glad I lost that job. Even though at the time I thought that was death to me, because if I hadn't lost for the job, I wouldn't have gone out and looked for a different one that got me to where God needed me to be. I'm glad some people walked back on promises. I remember when we, you know, when Kendra was pregnant with Chase, we were living in Georgia, had a good solid, we both had good jobs, but we realized with a baby coming in the world, I couldn't work an hour and 15 minutes southwest, and my wife worked 45 minutes due east. We had to figure out whose job we were going to keep and who was going to look for a different one so that we could triangulate our family together. And in the course of 30 days after learning that news, she was given an opportunity to transfer and I was given an opportunity for a promotion, and God was in everything. And then 60 days later, it all blew apart. After we had cut ties and were ready to move, the promotion I was offered was taken back off the table after a reconsideration, and the transfer job that she was given was filled by somebody else. And now instead of having four jobs to think about, we had zero. And when we had found out about the two transfer jobs, I got a call from Baltimore saying, hey, there's this campus of Echo Community Church. Would you think about it? I was like, no, thank you. 2 weeks later, all those other things fell apart. And then I called back and I said, hey, maybe I missed God. You see, God was trying to move us to Baltimore. It's not the same as what he was doing in Joseph. This is a micro scale. That's a macro scale. But I can tell you for sure, when I was in that, I was like, I do not know what God is doing. Is it because of something that I did wrong, that all these things are being walked back? This isn't fair. This isn't right. It was an injustice. It was scary, economically, spiritually, vocationally, everything. And yet I look back on it now and I thought, I would have never called Pastor George back and even entertained the idea of coming back to Baltimore had I not been in a cistern, so to speak. had I not felt like I have to cry out here. Now, fortunately, we were able to drive a U-Haul. I didn't have to ride on a camel. But God was managing all of those details, down to even us feeling betrayed in a certain way. Now, did God inspire someone to betray us? No, but he knew it was going to happen. And yet that person's sin was less powerful than God's ability to make righteousness out of it. That person's sin wasn't more powerful than God's ability to be a good planner. And so even though that person sinned and that wasn't God's idea and that wasn't his hope, that wasn't his strategy, that wasn't his plan, that sin was not powerful enough to thwart God's plan for my family. And had God delivered me from what I asked him to deliver me from and make it right, I wouldn't have moved to the place where God had for my family for this season of our life. Not all apples and oranges with Joseph. But maybe you can look back through the rearview mirror in life and say, thank God that relationship ended in a breakup. Thank God I didn't get that promotion. I thank God that this awful thing happened to me, though I would never want to go through it again. That thing shaped me in such a way that I made deep change in my life, and I didn't reciprocate and perpetuate that. That poison stopped with me. And had it not happened that way, I would not be able to be the person that I am today. In conclusion, worship team, why don't you come back? Let's close. God cares for us exactly as much in his hiddenness as he does in his dramatic interventions. In both his hiddenness and his interventions, he works for our redemption and our salvation. If you believe this with confidence, your life will be drastically different. I cobbled together this quote from David Guzik that I think summarizes it all. If Joseph's family wasn't messed up and weird, his brothers would never have considered selling him as a slave. If Joseph's brothers never sold him as a slave, then Joseph would never have gone to Egypt. If Joseph never went to Egypt, he never would have been sold to Potiphar. If Joseph would never sold to Potiphar, Potiphar's wife would never have falsely accused him of rape. If Potiphar's wife never falsely accused Joseph of rape, then Joseph would have never been put in prison. Listen, this is bad. This is bad. In fact, YouTube's probably tearing us down right now, okay? Like, this is not good. If Joseph was never put in prison, he never would have met the baker and the butler and the butcher and the candlestick maker, whoever they all were, of Pharaoh. If Joseph never met the baker and the butler of Pharaoh, he never would have interpreted their dreams. If Joseph never interpreted their dreams, he never would have interpreted Pharaoh's dream. If Joseph never interpreted Pharaoh's dream, he never would have become prime minister, second in Egypt only to Pharaoh. If Joseph never became prime minister, he never would have wisely prepared for the terrible famine to come. And if Joseph never wisely prepared for the terrible famine, then his family back in Canaan would have died in the famine. If Joseph's family back in Canaan died in the famine, then the Messiah could not have come from a dead family. And if the Messiah did not come forth, then Jesus never came. And if Jesus never came, we're all dead in our sins. Without hope in this world, we are thankful for God's great and wise plans. Amen? Let me pray over you today. Lord, for some of us this morning who are here or who are listening or who are watching, today is the day that we're going to confess to you our need to be saved and forgiven for the very first time. We thank you for a free gift of salvation that's made possible by you managing all the details, even in flawed families, and especially in flawed families like the one we read about in Genesis. Friend, if today is the day that you're ready to begin a relationship with God through Jesus and you feel that peace in your heart combined with an uneasiness in your heart over your own sin, but you feel peace about turning your life over to God, let me tell you how that happens. Apostle Paul says, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, and you believe in your heart God raised him from the dead, you'll be saved. That's all you have to do. Bring that to Jesus today, and your faith, his grace, that's what saves you. So confess to him right now. You might want to pray a prayer similar to this. Dear God, I agree with you that I'm a sinner, and I want forgiveness, and I need forgiveness. So please forgive me of my sins. Jesus, thank you for making it possible for me to be forgiven because you paid the penalty. You took the sentence that my crimes deserved, and you've satisfied that sentence so that I can just receive your resume that my debts have been paid in full. So please forgive me, Jesus. Thank you for your life and your death and your resurrection. Today, I'm also confessing that you are the Lord, and I'm going to live my life that way, like you're in charge and I'm not. But I'm going to need your help to do that. So will you send your Holy Spirit to live inside of me and begin to transform me into someone who's just like who you are, Jesus? Thank you for saving me. Amen.
We hope you enjoyed the Echo Community Church podcast. If you prayed that prayer at the end of the message and began following Jesus Christ today, we'd love to celebrate with you and give you some simple next steps to take as you begin your new life with Him. Just email us at info@echochurchmd.com to let us know. If you'd like more information about Echo Community Church, you can check out our Facebook page or our website, echochurchonline.com. Thanks so much for listening.